This is A Rude Awakening. I'm Sabrina Jacobs. On today's show, I'll speak to author David Sedlak on his latest book, Water for All, Global Solutions for a Changing Climate. We'll switch gears and hear an excerpt from a webinar put on by A Growing Culture featuring renowned seedologist and scientist, Dabal Deb. But first, the news.
You're listening to the 8 o'clock headlines. I'm Scott Baba. Russia has unleashed what may be one of the biggest aerial barrages against Ukraine so far in the war, killing several people, according to Ukraine's president. Julia Chapman reports.
Ukraine says Russia carried out one of its worst ever attacks on the country on Friday. At least 12 people have been killed and dozens are injured. President Volodymyr Zelensky says Moscow fired 110 missiles, 87 of which were shot down by air defenses. Those figures would make this Russia's largest aerial attack since its invasion of Ukraine. A spokesperson for Ukraine's Air Force says a wave of suicide drones was followed by missile launches from Russia. They took aim at Kyiv, Lviv, Odessa, Kharkiv, and Dnipro, leaving several buildings damaged and people trapped under the rubble. Ukrainian officials have warned that Russia was stockpiling weapons for a major attack. The Kremlin has yet to comment. Meanwhile, the Polish army says an unidentified aerial object entered the country's airspace from the border with Ukraine on Friday. I'm Julia Chapman.
Poland's defense forces say that all indications point to that object being a Russian missile. The defense forces said the object penetrated about 40 kilometers into Poland's airspace and left it after about 3 minutes. The defense forces said both its radar and NATO radar confirmed that the object left Polish airspace. It was not immediately clear where the object disappeared from radar or in which direction it had been going. There were no immediate reports of any explosion or casualties. Tens of thousands of Palestinians have streamed into a southern Gaza town as Israel expands its offensive in central Gaza, where hospital officials said dozens were killed today. Karen Chamis reports.
Israel told residents of central Gaza to head south, but even as the displaced have poured in, the southern town of Rafah has not been spared. A strike Thursday evening destroyed a residential building, killing well over a dozen people, according to the media office of the nearby Al-Kuwaiti hospital. By the site of the strike in Rafah, mourners gathered around an opened body bag, waiting for their turn to kiss the face of a loved one killed from the attack, as the sound of Israeli jets hovered above. Displaced resident Omar Kanan told the AP, "They're liars. They ask you to evacuate and send you to an area. And after many families gather there, they hit you." Israel blames the high death toll on Hamas, which it accuses of embedding inside the civilian population. I'm Karen Chamas.
An investigation by Amnesty International and the Washington Post claims the Indian government has repeatedly used spyware against journalists. Officials have denied the allegations, calling them half-facts and fully embellished. Ishan Garg has more.
A report by Amnesty International and Washington Post claims that two journalists, often critical of government's policies, were targeted. Indian officials allegedly used Israeli spyware Pegasus to target them. In October, several journalists and opposition party leaders said they had received a notification on their phones saying they could have been targets of state-sponsored hacking. Authorities say they are investigating these claims along with the tech giant Apple. The report now claims that the two journalists, Siddharth Varadarajan and Anand Manganale, received a text message which was designed to covertly install the spyware on their phones. A high-level committee in 2021 had not found any evidence of Pegasus on Varadarajan's phone. India's junior minister for information technology says these allegations by Washington Post and Amnesty are fabricated. Ishan Garg, New Delhi.
China has appointed a new defense minister after months of uncertainty following the firing of his predecessor for reasons that have yet to be explained. The official Xinhua news agency announced today that former Navy commander Dong Jun will serve in the largely ceremonial role, but offered no comment on the reasons for the switch or the current circumstances of previous minister Li Shengfu, who has not been seen or heard from since August. The uncertainty surrounding the leadership of the world's largest standing military comes as Washington and its Asian allies are offering stronger resistance to China's bid to assert itself as the dominant military power in the region. At least 20 people have died following landslides caused by torrential rains that hit the southern Kivu region in eastern Congo. Officials said today that the landslides swallowed up houses and dwellings in the locality of Bruhini in Mwenga territory, bringing to more than 60 the number of people who have died from flooding and landslides in the country this week. Observers have blamed the extent of the damage in southern Kivu on the illegal construction of houses in unauthorized locations. Since the beginning of December, at least 100 people have lost their lives as a result of torrential rains in the eastern part of Congo. The decision late yesterday by Maine's Secretary of State to ban former President Donald Trump from the ballot will inevitably increase pressure on the U.S. Supreme Court to settle the issue of Trump's eligibility once and for all. Catherine Carley filed this report.
All of this, I think, at least before the general, is screaming out for the Supreme Court to say, here's who is disqualified under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, and here's who is not.
Loyola Law School professor Jessica Levinson says the Supreme Court needs to rule on former President Donald Trump's right to hold office. On Thursday, Maine's Secretary of State removed Trump from the primary ballot there, a week after the Colorado Supreme Court also disqualified him because he led the January 6th insurrection. The Colorado GOP is appealing that ruling, and State Party Chair Dave Williams says if Trump isn't on the ballot, they could ignore the primary election and award delegates by caucus.
When you have unelected judges who were appointed by our opposition party dictating who we may nominate and who we may potentially vote on, we can't allow that to stand.
I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
The Justice Department warned Texas yesterday that it plans to sue over a new state law signed into law by Republican Governor Greg Abbott last week, which authorizes local and state police to arrest undocumented immigrants and empowers state judges to order such people removed from the country. Federal courts have long held that immigration enforcement is the responsibility of the federal government, not state or local authorities. San Francisco weather today, breezy with a chance of rain in the morning, then rain in the afternoon. Highs in the mid-60s, overnight showers and a slight chance of thunderstorms with lows in the lower 50s. Central Valley, partly sunny with a chance of rain in the afternoon. Highs in the high 60s, overnight rain with patchy fog and a chance of thunderstorms. I'm Scott Baba. Join us at 6 for the Pacifica Evening News.
Thank you.
all of us had these pandemic projects that just kind of hit us in the head, you know, if we were lucky enough to focus on them. But wow, okay, that's a long time. That's a long time. But again, you're not a lightweight. This is your baby. This is what you do over at UC Berkeley. So let's dive in. Let's talk about the six separate but interlinked water crises. You're identifying them for wealthy people that how they deal with it, the not so wealthy, unconnected, health, food, ecosystems. Talk to us, pick one and talk to us about it. And let's dive in.
Well, I'll tell you kind of the reason that I chose to subdivide the space into these six parts is that we often hear people talking about water crises or the global water crisis. And every time we hear the discussion, it seems like it's a different story. And I realize that when people say the world's facing a water crisis, it depends upon who's saying it and where they're located. And so people experience crisis in different ways because they use water in different ways. And so I chose to make this maybe artificial distinction among the different water crises because they're all driven by some of the same forces, and the approaches we can use to solve them have some similarities. But I thought it was better to do it this way so we could at least understand that there really are different drivers and different solutions. And so the first three crises, for example, are essentially one crisis: the crisis of drinking water, or water that you have to use in your home. And so you say, okay, well, everyone needs water in their home for cooking, for cleaning and sanitation, for washing. But, you know, it's quite different if you're in a wealthy country and you're a wealthy person living in a city versus if you're in a low-income country and you don't have a connection to a water source. And it's different yet again if you live in a low or middle-income country in a city where you have piped water coming into your home, but that piped water may not be safe to drink. And so I split the crises facing people and their need for household water into those three different bins, because it's a different story in terms of how you solve the crisis. So if you're in a wealthy country, you may be able to afford some sort of a high-tech solution like a desalination plant or an advanced water recycling plant. Whereas if you're in a middle-income country, you might turn towards a global development bank like the World Bank or the Asian Development Bank to help you build a water project. But your water utility probably can't rely upon raising the bills that they charge to customers or turning to the local government for subsidies like we do in wealthy countries. And if you're at the bottom of the pyramid and you're not connected to any water at all, you might be on your own or reliant upon international aid organizations to solve the problem. And so that's why I think it's helpful to subdivide the drinking water challenge into three separate crises.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. So if you're wealthy and you are living somewhere like, I don't know, the Bay Area, EB Mud, I mean, they're responsible for our water here in Northern California. And it's not the best water, but at the same time, you know, Northern California has gone through a huge drought up until about a year ago. We had all those crazy atmospheric rivers, and all of a sudden everything's still, the reservoirs are refilled and all of that. Talk to us about what it was like prior to dealing with that drought. They were hitting the groundwater, you know, pretty heavily, and just, you know, really destabilizing everything in that area as far as agriculture. Talk to us about how EB Mud was dealing with that. Go ahead.
Sure. Like, so first of all, I beg to differ a little. I think actually the water that people get in the Bay Area from EB Mud is some of the best tasting water of any city that I've been to. And they're doing a pretty good job because they have this imported water system from the eastern slopes, western slopes of the Sierra Nevada mountains that seems to do a pretty good job meeting our needs in the Bay Area. I think the place that really was stressed by the last drought was Southern California. And so in the book, I used the city of Santa Barbara as an example. And I use them as an example because they're a little bit of a special case. They were historically not tied into the imported water system that serves the rest of Southern California. So we all hear about the water that comes from the Colorado River or that comes from Northern California that goes all the way down to Southern California. Well, Santa Barbara, by a quirk of nature, the mountains that surround it, was never hooked up to that system. So they were on their own. Mm-hmm. And when they had, when they tried to address the drought that was that ended about 6 or 7 years ago, they built a seawater desalination plant. And that seawater desalination plant is capable of producing about a third of the water used in Santa Barbara. And that's the kind of solution that people in wealthy countries have the privilege and ability to access, something that, like, you know, you're never going to run out of water if you live on the coast in a wealthy city, because when push comes to shove, you can call a private company and they'll come in and build your city a desalination plant.
Wow. Are you serious? Oh my goodness. That is wonderful to hear. That is wonderful to know. That's amazing. That is, and it sounds expensive though, David. It sounds really, really expensive.
It was more expensive than their current water supplies, but compared to their other options, it was perhaps the least expensive option, even compared to their remaining conservation options. And so the reliability of it was really the big attraction for them. So when you build a desalination plant, you know that you're going to have water if there's a drought. And that's what attracts cities in wealthy countries to desalination.
Wow, I would love to try some. I would really love to try some.
Well, if you want to try something just like it, if you've ever had the bottled water that you get from Coca-Cola or Pepsi, Dasani or Aquafina, that's produced by the exact same process, reverse osmosis. So the technology that's used to turn seawater into drinking water is the same one that those large beverage companies use to make their water taste the same everywhere in the world. The difference is that after the bottlers take the salts out of the water, they put some salts in to give it a uniform flavor. So anywhere in the world that you drink those products, they'll taste exactly the same, irrespective of where the bottler got the water from.
Interesting. That is crazy. That is something else. That is wonderful. That is wonderful. So communities on the front lines of previous crises have pioneered approaches with, like you're saying, the desalination, and can be adapted to other struggling communities. And usually how, you know, we're looking at how the wealthy, which is the global north, versus how the not wealthy, which is the global south, are dealing with these water crises around the ever-changing climate crisis. Talk to us some more about the other three bullet points of your book. And again, folks, the book is called Water for All: Global Solutions for a Changing Climate. David Sedlak, go ahead.
Well, okay, I think it's important to understand the people in the middle. That is, you know, if there are 8 billion people on Earth and there's about a billion people in the global north, then there's about a billion people who are completely disconnected from water sources. That leaves about 6 billion people in the middle. And a lot of those people live in cities and they do have access to water. So if you've ever traveled in that part of the world, you know that most people have a faucet in their home, or they have access to a faucet with flowing water, but that water may not be running 24 hours a day. And when it is running, most people don't drink it without first boiling it or treating it in some way. Mm-hmm. And so that's a situation that most people on Earth are familiar with. And it's gotten better in the last 50 years as those countries have become wealthier, but there still are some major challenges. And because the cities in low and middle income countries are developing so quickly, it's really hard for the people who operate the water systems to keep up. For example, in the second half of the 19th century, the population of London doubled about once every 50 years. Today, in sub-Saharan Africa and in South America, the megacities are doubling in population once every 15 to 20 years. And so if you think about how long it takes us to build highways and buildings and water systems, you realize that you're constantly in this race to provide more water as your city grows. You may not have enough money to do it. And then superimposed on top of that, you have this more variable climate. And so there's a real challenge of growing the water systems. And at the same time, there's a challenge of collecting money from the water users, because in many low and middle income countries, the people who use the majority of the water may not have the means to pay for it. And so in some cases, you have cities providing water for people and not billing them, or you have people with illicit connections to the water system. And so the cities are constantly struggling for revenue. And so you get into a situation where it's really hard to manage the water systems. And that can often lead to crises when climate change results in scarcity.
No doubt. My goodness. My goodness. Totally, totally, totally. So, I mean, you've been at this your whole career. Your whole career. So, I mean, you've come up with these amazing answers. And what has been the reception of your books, your talks, by governmental organizations like EBMUD, throughout the country, throughout the state of California, throughout the world? Are they listening to you? Because, you know, it's like, hey, wait a minute, I've got the answers.
Well, I think a lot has changed in the last 15 or 20 years, especially in the Western U.S. with the droughts. We have, we have water utilities and government agencies and others signing on to this idea that we need to start treating our water as what many refer to as one water. So when I started working in this area, there were people who did water supply, there were people who did flooding, people who did sewage treatment, people who did stormwater, whatever it was, and they didn't talk to each other. And now they're realizing that we're all in it together, and that we can solve problems in a manner that helps everyone involved in the situation. So there's a rays of hope there.
How could they not be talking to each other?
Well, I mean, historically, when water was plentiful and these weren't issues, everything was just go, go, go. And there were different groups doing different things. But now that water has become more limited, we do have this movement towards not only talking to each other, but educating people in the field about some of these solutions. So I'm optimistic about that. And I'm also optimistic that many of these solutions, which at first seemed like they were out of reach of people due to their complexity or cost, are coming down in price. So if you can think about the early days of solar panels, when they were playthings of the wealthy. And now you see solar panels not only on all the homes in the suburbs, but you see them in low-income countries and in rural communities. I think we're starting to see some of the same sorts of water technologies that I told you about in Santa Barbara showing up in low and middle-income countries and showing up in water kiosks that compete with trucked water in rural communities in low-income countries and in cities where people can't trust the water. So I think we're starting to see a movement where folks are starting to take their water into their own hands. And every year, there's more and more technological options that can help them realize that dream of having a safe and secure water supply.
Yeah, that's where it comes, what it comes down to, safe and secure water supply. I'm still floored by the fact that all these people that, you know, these agencies that work with different forms of water, whether it be, you know, treatment of the water, providing potable water, and not talking to each other. It's like, that's just bizarre. It really does not make any kind of sense. But, well, it's people like you that are bringing all of these governmental agencies together and saying, hey, this is what's up. We're running into an issue. So with this last year here in Northern California, I mean, it was a phenomenon with these atmospheric rivers, right? I mean, that was just nuts with all the rain that we got.
Yeah, it rained. It rained just like in the old days, huh? Like in the 80s and 90s when it was wet and cold in California.
Yeah, when we actually had, like, you know, the California version of four seasons, right?
Right.
But it's the unpredictability of the unpredictability of climate change. Talk to us about that. As far as, we don't know if we're going to have another crazy, you know, atmospheric river party like we had a year ago. You know, David, talk to us about how flexible we need to be as far as this the climate crisis is concerned as it relates to water.
Well, here in the Western U.S., I think variability in weather patterns has been the rule and not the exception. So we've had a long history of wet and dry seasons, but the rest of the country isn't used to that. And we're seeing things here that we had never seen before. You know, some of these summer storms, which are pretty unusual, are becoming more commonplace. And perhaps at some point we'll see a big increase in the amount of rain on the wet years and longer droughts, which seems to be the predicted pattern. I think that the real issue is that now everyone has to be prepared for these longer droughts and these more extreme bounce backs. And that means that we may have to adapt the water systems that we have. So, for example, if you're managing your reservoir to prevent flooding, you try to leave it nearly empty when the winter comes. If you're managing your reservoir because you're afraid of a drought, you try to make sure that it's half full or more approaching the winter rainy season. So we have to rethink a lot of the past notions about how we managed our water systems. And perhaps most importantly for us in the West, we have to start thinking about using the underground, that is the groundwater aquifers under our feet, for water storage, because those are the things that will help us ride out these longer dry periods that we're likely to face.
Most definitely. And just, I don't know, I imagine some big lever, you know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
It's coming, you know?
Yeah, no, it's certainly not that simple. It's going to take some trial and error, and it's going to take some creative people. But the plumbing system that was built by our grandparents and great grandparents isn't really up to the challenge we face. And by plumbing, I mean the big system, those canals and reservoirs and pipelines that we see. That might have made sense in the 60s and 70s, but it's got to be rethought a bit as we go into a different climate.
Most definitely, most definitely. And I think we're on it. I think we're on it here in California. Definitely, definitely do. But yeah, I don't like the water here at AB Mud.
Oh, I'm yeah, so sorry.
I think maybe if I went straight to the source, you know, maybe it's the piping, you know, maybe new piping or something like that. Uh-huh. But yeah, I'm just like
quite often if people don't like the taste, you can put it through one of those carafe filters like the Brita filters. And what it does is it takes the chlorine out. So a lot of times what people object to in their water is the taste of the chlorine. And that chlorine's there to protect you from bacteria or microbes that might get into it. But it doesn't taste pleasant. So that's one way I think that you could make that East Bay Mud tap water taste a little nicer.
Yeah, and then they've got those those sticks, those charcoal sticks.
Yep,
you can put in there too. I have not tried that, so I'll probably have to try that and see if that makes it a little bit more tasty. But these EB Mud folks need to read your book, David Sedlak.
I think some of them already have, because I wander around, and when I see them, I give them a copy.
That is good. That is a good thing. That is a good thing, because this climate crisis, it's just every year we don't know what El Nino and La Nina are going to be doing. We don't know what they're up to. You know, they're rubbing their hands together, and it's like drought. You know, no drought. You know what I mean? We don't know what's going to happen. We don't know what's going to happen. We got to get ready and be prepared if we want to keep on living. Well, David, my goodness, it is so nice to have a conversation with somebody who's not talking about COP28. David, is there anything else you want to throw in, you want to close us out with? Go right ahead.
Okay. Well, I think as long as we're on the topic of climate change, we should realize that water is one of the primary ways in which we will experience a changed climate. And when it comes to water, we have a lot of options for adapting our water systems to provide us with household water, to have enough water to grow food, to have enough water to support the environment. But the time to act is before we reach a state of crisis. So it's time to get to work, because we know that we're going to have to remake our water systems.
No doubt. Absolutely. Absolutely. And it can happen. Again, his latest book, Water for All, Global Solutions for a Changing Climate, David Sedlak. Thank you so much. That's a Yale Press. It is out on Yale Press. So pick it up. Folks here in the Bay Area, you know, I've seen and heard so many different innovations as far as irrigating gardens and gray water capture. And we're an innovative group out here. So it's wonderful to have you, Berkeley-based David Sedlak, spreading the word and getting it out there on a national and international level. Thank you so much for being on A Rude Awakening. Appreciate you, David.
Thanks for having me. I enjoyed the discussion.
Now we're going to feature an excerpt from a webinar put on by A Growing Culture featuring renowned farmer, seedologist, and scientist Dabal Deb with Chef Dan Garber. For context, A Growing Culture is a food sovereignty organization. You can check them out at agrowingculture.org, agrowingculture.org. They also have a YouTube channel. And the links will be on A Rude Awakening's social media sites. This webinar was filmed about 3 years ago, and it is the second in a series entitled Hunger for Justice. Let's take a listen to Dabal Deb and Dan Garber on Seed Sovereignty.
This story begins from a big prehistory, which is about 10,000 to 12,000 years ago, when rice was first domesticated in India. And since that period of domestication of rice, unnamed, unknown farmer scientists since the period of the early Neolithic farmers had created thousands and thousands of varieties, locally adapted rice varieties. So that until 1970, it's officially recorded that 110,000 varieties roughly were in existence in India, and of which 65,000 varieties were shipped to the International Rice Research Institute in the Philippines between 1965 and 75, which is the first decade of the Green Revolution in India. Since this advent of the Green Revolution, India has actually lost more than 110,000 folk rice varieties because they were all replaced with a handful of modern high-yielding varieties within just 40 years. And with the result that today, all over India, we have no more than 6,000 rice varieties left living on farmers' fields. Now, with this background information, I wanted to save and safekeep whatever is remaining in India, at least to create a kind of hub of seed exchange center where farmers can freely access and exchange the seeds so that no more of these varieties which are remaining are lost anymore in the future. So with this objective, we created VIHI, the seed bank, which is a Sanskrit name for rice. And this is now the Asia's largest non-governmental seed bank for rice, which is open source too, that began in 1997. And since that date, till date, we are growing 1440 varieties of rice. We are growing every year and distributing the seeds for free among all farmers. Now these 1440 varieties, we have amazing properties, different kinds of agronomic properties and morphological and nutritional properties. So we have 15 varieties of salt-tolerant rice. Yeah, salt-tolerant means, they can tolerate seawater. They can grow in seawater. And they can tolerate the incursion of seawater every year on the coastal saline lands. We have 17 varieties of flood-tolerant rice, and that means some of them can grow up 12 feet, they can grow in 12 feet deep water. Drought tolerant rice, 192 fragrant rice, apart from basmati, and iron rich rice, vitamin A rich rice, vitamin B3 and B4 rich rice, antioxidant rich rice, pest resistant, disease resistant, and super yield varieties, which actually the yield exceeds any of these modern high yielding varieties. So all of these varieties we grow and distribute among the farmers and also document the characteristics of each of these varieties every year. And so one example of this, the flood tolerant rice is that, you can see this farmer who was so proud and happy to show off his flood tolerant rice, which he grew in his 8 feet deep pot. This photo was after he had harvested, but he kept the last few cumes for photography, and he was proud of this one, which was growing in his 8 feet deep pond water. And we have this amazing, just an example of this, this is our answer to the biotechnological solution that people think that, we can solve our food security and nutritional security from biotechnology. And the last line in this table, the last row is, genetically modified iron fortified rice, which genetic engineers believe that this will solve the anemia, which is endemic in majority of the global south. This incorporated soya gene for ferritin enzyme, and this contains 7.2 milligram per kg, 7.2 milligram of iron per kg of rice. And they claim that this is a hugely high iron rich rice. The one just above this, the penultimate line, is IR68144, which was developed in IRRI, and there the content of iron is 8.9. Now, compared with these, the dozens of rice varieties, we are not going to show you all these 78. We have more than 78 varieties, which are very high rich in iron. And now look at this, 40 mg per kg, 130, 150, 80, 60. All of these are grown by these indigenous farmers, developed and created by unnamed, unknown farmer scientists who did not know what DNA is, who did not know about the enzyme actions, but they achieved it. And they're growing it with zero investment of industry. But anyway, the common sense would always say that no, we should promote those traditional varieties for our food security and nutritional security and curing of anemia, rather than investing millions of dollars in developing this soy ferritin gene rice. But common sense is very uncommon among policymakers. We all know that. But that's the answer. We have already given this. It's another amazing innovation by the farmers, unknown, unnamed farmer scientists who developed this unique variety of rice. In each spikelet, you can see the photograph. In each spikelet, there are three rice grains, three kernels inside. We have just a couple of years ago, we identified the genes responsible for over-duplication and multiplication, replication genes. But this is a feat which genetic engineers not yet have imagined about developing this. But farmers, this farmer, we don't know his name or her name, and they developed this without any investment or industry or without knowing anything about DNA or protein or enzymes. Now, we grow them and distribute these seeds and also train these farmers, indigenous farmers, in different techniques of rice characterization so that they will be able to identify the off types in order to maintain the genetic purity of each land race that they are growing, so that even after cross-pollination or even accidental physical mixing, they can identify this the genuine ones and eliminate the off types. So this type of training is given so that each of these varieties are kept in their genetic purity and the characteristics. You can see there's another visuals of this. Now you can see the top row is the raw rice and the bottom row is the milled rice that we eat. Now you can see this in the diversity of color, size, shape, and all this, but you cannot get an idea of the aroma or the taste of each of these rice varieties, whether one is sticky or not, whether one is, it's a very quickly boiling, quickly cooked rice, or which one is vitamin A rich rice, which one has high antioxidant content, which one has high vitamin B4 content, and so on and so forth.
But Dibal, can I just interrupt you for a moment? I just want to make sure. Sorry to cut you off, but what is the difference between the top row and the bottom row?
Oh, the top row is the raw rice with the hull, and the bottom row is when you remove the hull by milling.
Ah, okay, sorry.
So the bottom row is the milled rice, which you cook for eating.
Yeah.
Okay. And so Vrihi not only distributes and gives out those seeds, but also distributes the seeds of different varieties and species of legumes, or beans, 32 different varieties of aubergines, which we grow, and also distribute the seeds of among the farmers. And then different species and varieties of millets, finger millets and foxtail millets and pearl millets, and just giving examples, and many, many other crops and vegetables too. Then Vrihi becomes the hub, a central distribution center of all the seeds among the farmers. And it's definitely, always free of cost. Everyone can come and approach and exchange seeds or take the seeds, pay for free. The only condition for the recipients, farmers, is that they must not sell the seeds. They are, of course, free to make money by selling the rice varieties as food, or processed food or whatever, but never as seed, because seeds are the commons. It's a global commons. No individual or a corporation has any moral right to own them and to sell them, because seeds always, from the beginning of this, the agriculture was the world commons, global commons. We are only their custodians of these seeds, which were invented and discovered and developed by those unnamed, unknown farmer scientists for thousands of years. We are only custodians, and we cannot be judged. So that's the way Vrihi distributes these seeds to a circle of these farmers. They can either give in exchange another variety back to Vrihi, which we give over to another farmer, or if it's very distant farmer, then they can give away this sample of this variety after they harvest in the next season, after they multiply, they can give it over to another farmer. So this way there's an expanding circle of exchange and it keeps on expanding every year. Yes, Dan. Sorry, I can't hear you. I can't hear you, Dan.
Sorry. Yeah. Sorry to interrupt you again, but you've hit on an important point here that I just don't want to wait till the end because we should think about this infused into everything we discussed today. And that is that your talk here is being sponsored by a seed company for which we sell seeds. And so my question is, how do you square the modern commerce of seeds with what you just said? Is there a place for it? And if you don't have to answer it now, we could start with just responding, but we could also answer it when you're done with your presentation. But
I'll tackle that with you shortly, and then we'll get back to that question immediately.
Okay, good.
So with this kind of, you know, the seed commons, we are, our model is that, you know, every village or every community should be, you know, developing this kind of seed banks in every village. That's the ideal. But at least, you know, the local in-situ seed banks in every district, that's our idea. And we are promoting and establishing many kinds of, you know, replications of the seed bank like Brihi. And the expanding circles of exchange is growing. Now, currently, over these, you know, past 15, 20 years, we have more than 17,000 farmers who have received seeds from Brihi, directly or indirectly. And now this number is growing, and they're all growing this and distributing it for free to all the other farmers. And this is the actual, the answer, a parallel to the seed corporation, the seed industry, the biopiracy over these indigenous seeds and the business, which is illegal and immoral, I consider. Because this, without this kind of, you know, ownership, commons ownership, community ownership over the seeds, food sovereignty is not successful. And food sovereignty, which has been eroded by four attacks by industrialization of agriculture. First is monocultures, so that, you know, the diversity of crops and their polyculture system is destroyed. The second is the market dependence, building market dependence of the farmers on these corporate sectors or the government for seeds, agrochemicals, and machinery. Third is the destruction of the tradition of seed exchange network, not only seed, but knowledge exchange and all of these, so that everyone is now made to depend on some external agency, an expert agency, whether it's for seed or for machinery or for some technology. And the third is that, you know, the prioritization of the individual monetary gains, how you make money from your food rather than food itself. So food becomes a commodity, monetization of the food itself, which is over the long-term community benefits. Once we take care of these, then of course, you know, the food farmers' seeds of sovereignty and food sovereignty will take place, will be successful all over the world. That used to be. And the seed commons to me is just the beginning with the rice and whatever. The seed bank is just a handle toward achieving sustainability on all lives, you know, the entire life of humans, you know, your lifestyle, your how you live in your city or village. And the commons, you know, that includes, you know, many kinds of village woodlots which have been destroyed. So we are also trying to recreate those village woodlots which were destroyed or lost. We are protecting sacred groves and sacred ponds, which were the last bastions of biodiversity, critically endangered species. Trying to revive them, reciprocal labor exchange arrangements, and reviving traditional sports and folk musical traditions, which were also reinforcing the communitarian ethos. We are recuperating them from the, you know, onslaught of this corporatized crickets, for example. This Vitex is one example, like Labrata, is a critically endangered species which we rescued from the verge of extinction using tissue culture in my own lab and replanted, you know, some of the last saplings in the villages. And we have this, you know, the making this, you know, explanations, explaining the importance of sacred groves. This is one village sacred grove, and explaining this, you know, the history and biodiversity of that particular sacred grove to a group of youth from 20 villages. So this is a unique sacred grove in Bengal with a very rich biodiversity, some unique biodiversity spectrum. We're also reviving many traditional forgotten sports, including archery and stilt race and all of these, where boys and girls now are participating from different parts of the country. And every year we hold this kind of tournaments so that they can again revive those, you know, traditional community, you know, community resource with this involvement of the community, not just cricket, which is sponsored by multinationals. And also reviving many kinds of, you know, traditional Baul Gharana is a special ancient musical tradition in Bengal. And lastly, we also hold annual festivals of food festivals, traditional foods. We name it Taste of Diversity. Because when you say 1,400 varieties, it's just a number. Intellectually, you understand it's a big number, but it has no meaning to you as an organism until you taste it. So you get, you know, when you taste 40 different varieties, you get, you know, different taste, different aroma, different color, sticky rice, non-sticky rice, and all of this. Then you get the meaning of this number of this, you know, 1,400 varieties, meaning 14 different tastes and aroma and color. That's how, you know, people get reintroduced to this, you know, the meaning of diversity, the taste of diversity. And this is how, this is only this, you know, one way, the last way of reimagining what we have lost, you know, the alternative to this current model of development. Can we imagine another kind of development where the right of the individual or corporation is abrogated, the right to their freedom and their right to deprive others of nature's services? Can we imagine that, you know, the right of not only the current members, the contemporary members of the community, but also the future members, the members who are not yet born in the community, and their environmental rights and social rights are upheld? With that, you know, idea in this one, that's the meaning of the commons. And that's why we have to recuperate this commons in the community ethos rather than privatization and individualization, monetization of the resources. Thank you. I think now we can start answering your questions from now on. And
Well, can we just start off with the elephant in the room, or the seed company in the room, that wants to do the right thing and supports everything that you said? I'll speak on behalf of the entire company and probably speak on behalf of everybody who is listening to you right now. I would imagine that if we were to poll the people listening into this, it would be unanimous in support of your work and in support of the themes of your work. My question is, where does a seed company, I would ask about commerce after this, but just seed commerce and a seed company selling seeds, how does it work in your mind in an ideal way?
I am, on principle, I'm against this kind of seed business itself, because seeds should not be sold and bought in the first place, because nobody owns a seed unless one actually develops a new type of seed. Of course, it's they have the right. But I'm talking of this, you know, the indigenous seeds, which were, you know, by thousands and thousands, were developed over centuries and centuries by unnamed, unknown farmers who never made money with this. So, for example, every item of food that we eat today all over the world, you know, the rice that you eat today, or the wheat that you eat, the bread, the wheat was actually developed, and all the varieties were developed by Mesopotamian farmers 10,000 years ago in Iraq. Or the corns were developed by this, you know, Mesoamerican farmers, potato, tomato, cabbage, cauliflower in Serbia. Now, we don't imagine, nobody could thought, you know, in the 16th century when this, you know, the new world crops were brought to Europe, nobody thought of paying a royalty to them, the South American farmers, for eating potato or tomato. Now, we have to pay for all of these kind of expropriated materials with just a tinkering of this variety of our hybridization. And then we have to pay, the farmers have to pay to the company, but not the original cultivators who developed and created those varieties in the first place. That's why we consider this is unethical. I would rather say that, you know, if it's a special kind of variety, even this, you know, what kind of special variety, that's a big question. I mean, as I give an example of this, you know, this variety of rice with 150 ppm of metal, of iron, for example, or a variety which contains silver. And we discovered this, the only variety that contains silver in this grain, is a medicinal variety. The originator of these varieties never made money. Now if a company comes and makes a patent on it, this is biopiracy. This is immoral. So I refused. And if this kind of a company comes over to pay me to sponsor my work, I refuse. I have refused all the time. I have never received any kind of corporate support till date. But of course, if an individual, even working with a seed company, wants to support this kind of work as an individual, I welcome that. But yeah, not from this company. That's it.
And again, there are no arguments except the question. Well, I have two now that came out of what you just said. One is, you said, well, I Dibal, I'm okay with a seed company that develops a new variety. Well, then it's okay to sell. But developing a new variety is just piggybacking on the inventions of the past, on those farmers that you said were never paid. So, yes. So there is really no commerce in your mind that as we look to a future food system with diversity, with regional adaptation, with diversity and nutrition and flavor,
exactly,
where does commerce play in that? If we're always... Exactly.
You're very right. You're very right. I mean, this is the main, it's simply making money is the motivational factor. It's not helping the farmer. It's not nutrition to the consumer. It's just making money. And every single hybrid,
Again, folks, if you want to check out any food sovereignty videos by A Growing Culture, you can look them up on their YouTube channel, A Growing Culture. You can also go to their website, agrowingculture.org, agrowingculture.org. And that does it for another edition of A Rude Awakening. I'm Sabrina Jacobs. A big thank you to my guest, David Senlak, for taking the time. I'm not sure who is on the controls, but I thank them immensely for being there. The music on today's show was Moonshine Part 1 by Elephantine. A gentle reminder, folks, that we're still pushing for some extra funds. Thanks to you for a very successful fund drive. We love you for it, but we're still in need of a few more dollars. So if you can, go to kpfa.org, become a sustainer, or do the one-time option. Whatever you can, every little bit helps. Stay tuned for a rebroadcast of Democracy Now! Coming up next. And remember, good people, embrace each other as we embrace the mother of us all. Happy New Year to you all, and thank you for listening.
One of the things I love about my role here at KPFA is I get to hear directly from you, our listeners. My name is Italina, Donor Relations Manager here at the station, and I get to hear things like, thank you for being here for our community. And we get to be here thanks to loyal listeners like you. So help us continue to be here by making a meaningful donation today. And no, there is more than one way to donate. You can make a qualified charitable distribution from an IRA. You can donate stocks. You can even add KPFA as a beneficiary. Thank you for being really thoughtful about this. Thank you to our monthly sustainers and to our generous one-time donors. Donate at kpfa.org or email members@kpfa.org if you have a question about donating in other ways or if you'd like to increase your monthly donation. My name is Italina, here for Community Powered Radio, here for you.
2024 is right around the corner, and at KPFA, we're beginning to plan our 75th birthday celebration. Also in 2024, we're preparing for the daunting task of extensive quality coverage of national, state, and local elections for you. Help us continue building community trust and stay as vigilant as always. Please consider making a holiday tax-deductible donation today at kpfa.org. Thank you.
You're listening to 94.1 KPFA and 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, 97.5 K248VR in Santa Cruz, and online worldwide at kpfa.org.